I'm Debbie. I'm an alcoholic. Me and y'all aren't wasting time. We're going to get right down to it. That's how I was about my drinking. Let's get right to it. Thank y'all so much. Thanks, Billy and Sam, for inviting me. And it really is an honor to be here. And I feel like I'm here. We kind of rushed. I prayed on the way here because I don't like being late. I like to show up on time, but I'm here. So, but anyway, my sobriety date is May 30th, 2006. That is not my first sobriety date, but I hope to God it's my last. I'm willing to do whatever I have to do, even to drive to Madison on a crappy day like today. I mean, sign me up if I don't have to drink again. And I have a home group. It's going on right now. It's an awesome group. It's Speaking of Steps. It's at 6:30 on Sundays. It's a closed discussion meeting. And we do a step each week, and then we have people share that have worked that step. So I like solution-based meetings. I've got a bad case of alcoholism that almost killed me, so I need to hear a real solid solution on AA. I have a job in that home group. Get to be the GSR. Willing to do whatever I have to do to help support the meeting. I have a great sponsor. She's a wonderful example of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's leads by example, inspires me, and lives a life based on the principles, all 36. She's told me we got 36. I thought there were 12. She's right now taking me through the concepts. I'm like, oh my God, this is advanced AA. I can't wait to speak again and impress everyone. And anyway, it's interesting, though, but, you know, I'm very grateful for that I have a sponsor that really lives this way of life and shows me through her example of the 12 steps in my own life, the traditions, and now beginning the concepts. And then I have the honor and privilege of people that ask me to sponsor them. And I've got several folks right now, and, you know, it's just... God, it's just an awesome thing for someone that's dying, like I was dying, that comes to me, and it makes all my boo-boos okay, because that's where all the past, all the horrible things that happened to me, being an alcoholic, that are my greatest assets, that I get to sit down with a person that was dying just like I was, and I get to share from my heart my own experience, my dark, musty past, as the book talks about, and give them hope. So funny, James and I, this is my friend James, and he's awesome. We were on the way here, and I get a call. And this is a perfect example of your worst being your best. Girl's calling me, want to know, she has a friend that needs to go into a psych ward, and she knows I've been in many, so she was wanting my recommendation on the best psych ward. And I suggested St. Mary's because I really like them. They were really nice to me there. Let's see, I've been in many psych wards. Been to Tucker's many times, drunk and sober, and St. Mary's, I had my five-year anniversary there at the last time I was sober, because I was having a nervous breakdown. And then that's where the last detox. And September 18th of 2005, when I almost died, that was there. So I said, go there, that's good. They're all good. So anyway, he started laughing because he knew, you know, it was like, see, I'm telling you, like, people are calling me on recommendations for psych wards. I mean, so anyway, let's see. So I give my sobriety date, May 30th, 2006, my sponsor, who's awesome, and then the fact that I get to sponsor people. And, you know, as far as a lot of people, like, you know, well, I'm the sponsor, and you're going to do what I say. I'm not. All I have is my experience and what is in this book. I am a big book girl. Some people call AA Nazi or whatever. I'm like, that's fine. Maybe I won't die then. You know, I'd rather be an AA Nazi than a half-baked whatever and end up dying like I almost did. So, anyway, you know, I get to be, as my sponsor says, a tour guide. You know, all I have, people are going to do what they're going to do, but I got a real solid solution that's worked for me. Let me show you. And it's my job and my responsibility to give people the best that AA has to offer. And so I try to sponsor people. I am sponsored in the middle of the circle and the triangle, you know, the Unity Service Recovery, a lot of you know that. And, you know, a lot of days when I'm not feeling good, you know, what my sponsor does with me is we look at where I am in the middle of the circle and the triangle. You know, am I keeping on my commitments and going to my meetings? And I go to a lot of meetings. I have four committed, my home group. And, you know, my commitments to AA, like GSR, am I keeping all those commitments? Yes, I am. Where am I? Am I working with my sponsees, taking them through the steps? Am I being honest with my sponsor? Yes, I am. Am I being of service? You know, we look at all sides of that. And she says, well, Debbie, you're really actually doing fantastic. You're just not feeling good. And then we look at what's going on with me. Am I getting along with my husband? Am I lying? What am I doing? Well, you know, there's this thing called the human condition. You know, for some reason, I think I'm supposed to, you know, come to AA, you know, run my life in the ground and be an emotional wreck and end up in psych wards and come here and half-ass work a few steps, come around 30 days, and then I'm supposed to feel good all the time. I mean, delusion at best, and I see a lot of people that way, and that's why they can't stay sober and they die. You know, I'm not willing to be uncomfortable. I want, you know, maximum benefit for no activity, you know. And, you know, I always just make me feel good. But anyway, we were just talking about that, too. The things we do, you know, to make you take away my, you know, alcohol and my psychotropics I'm using to try to fix my alcoholism, then I must feel good. And now, you know, and I will go out and spend a lot of money, or I wish I was one that went out and had a lot of sex. I'm too much of a prude to do that, but I understand that's a lot of fun. It makes you feel really good for about 30 minutes until the guilt, remorse, and shame kicks in. So, you know, so I'm grateful that I've been willing to be uncomfortable, to get comfortable, to be lost, to find myself, and for the real me to show up. And the real me is really cool. I am, like, some people think I'm right crazy, but I have a lot of fun. I have enough sponsees to ask me to sponsor them, so I must not be too crazy, or maybe they're crazy. I don't know. It doesn't matter. You know, I am okay in my own skin today, and that is a miracle because I've lived my whole life trying to be who I thought that you thought I needed to be so I could be okay. You know, I used to, like, want people to like me that I didn't even like because I was so small. And so, like, had no idea who I was. That I need outside validation in what type of car I drive, what type of clothes I wear, what type of house and all that. And then, you know, needing people to validate me. And so, you know, I end up in the hospital almost dying. You know, I had 6 years of sobriety and relapsed and went crazy and end up in the hospital. And then I'm in rehab again in 2005. And I turned 46, and I remember coming out of that alcoholic clonopin haze, and I'm like, oh, my God, what happened? And who am I? I'm a 46-year-old woman, and I have no clue who I am, and I remember just feeling so desolate and lost and scared and, like, you know, living in this alternative world of an alcoholic clonopin haze for so many years and then just coming to and, like, ew. You know, and fortunately, I was willing to take the actions, and Alcoholics Anonymous works. I'm standing here. I should be dead. And so I'm a believer. I am. So anyway, that twang you hear is a Kentucky accent. I grew up in Owensboro, Kentucky, and I'm the youngest of three girls, and My dad was a boilermaker, and he was a good man. He worked, you know, and provided for the family. My mom was a homemaker, and, you know, we weren't poor and we weren't rich. I guess we were just real middle class, a little rancher, and, you know. And what happened is my dad was an alcoholic. But he was one of those that would work, and a lot of the boilermakers, that type of trade, they're drinkers and drug users and all that. You know what boilermakers are. You know exactly what it is. And he would work and provide, and we'd have, you know, very structured during the week. Dinner would be on the table at 5, and, you know, all of that. We had chores. But then when he would drink, it would get real interesting. And it really was, I need to sit down and write a country western song because my dad would get drunk and like to listen to a lot of Charlie Pride and, you know, all those old guys, and I hated country music. And he would get on his vodka and he would drink, and it would be like he would go into a blackout, and he would beat the hell out of my mom. He'd bust her teeth. She had false teeth and had to go, you know, fist through the walls. He'd bring home, you know, drunk friends that would try to molest me and my little sister, my other sisters, and he would get in blackouts and get shotguns out, cocked and ready to go, saying he was going to blow our heads off. That's a little bit traumatic, you know. And then what would happen is I would be scared to death, and I'd be on my... I was very spiritual at a young age, wonder why, and I remember the one night he was going to blow our heads off. Me and my sisters lived in a... we lived in a two-story home at the time. We were upstairs. My mom came up to the upstairs. There were two bedrooms, and she was just shaking and crying. And then I opened the door, and there's my dad with this shotgun. I'm going to blow your heads off if you all come down. And I remember going and get my rosary and get on my knees and praying and praying. And then what would happen with stuff like that is they would get in a fight. He would sober up. He would have remorse. They would kiss and make up. Then my mom would beat the hell out of us. So she was an untreated Al-Anon. He was an untreated alcoholic. So that's what I grew up in. And, you know, it wasn't, like, what I know now is they were really doing the best they could. He was doing what blackout vodka drinkers do. So the gift I've been given is realizing, you know, my dad was a great guy. He was a blackout vodka drinker. Hell, he didn't know he was doing that. I think I got more upset when he took my kitty cat and put it in the freezer and froze it to death than, and like, obviously, I threatened to blow my head off. You know, he did some crazy stuff. So as a result, now, you know, the only reason I'm telling you, I prayed and I asked God, you know, so for some reason that's showing up and I don't know why, but that's the environment I grew up in. Now, on the normal days, you know, I had food on the table, I had clothes to wear, I had, you know, the normal life. So I started out life with this just total, like, never knowing what's going to happen. As a result of that, I always had this lifelong severe panic, anxiety disorder, and post-traumatic stress. And alcohol really helps soothe that out. And what I'd like to say is alcohol was a solution to my alcoholism for many years. I am grateful for alcohol. I'm grateful for the drinks that I had because I think I probably would have blown my brains out because I was very scared. I mean, I still have great amounts of fear. Well, not great amounts. I haven't ended up in a psych ward for a nervous breakdown since 2005. But it is something that's... that I've had to deal with, and the steps to work and God, and the power of God, and the power of the steps have helped to keep that at bay, so that I can function properly. But that is probably my cross to bear: is sometimes just tremendous amounts of fear for no reason. But I just feel it because I was kind of grew up that way of just you don't know what's going to happen next. Oh my God! So anyway, you know, that does not make me an alcoholic at all, but it certainly adds a dimension to my isms, you know, and some of the things I've had to deal with in recovery. So anyway, grew up in that environment, and a lot of people say, you know, I had a lot of fear. Well, I did, and I had a good reason to have a lot of fear, but I know people that didn't have that type of upbringing. My grand sponsor, who spoke this morning, I went to my sponsor's home group anniversary meeting, and my grand sponsor spoke, and she grew up in just this beautiful, delightful, church-going Southern Baptist family, and she said she was fine until she was age 5 and then started feeling weird and full of fear. So, you know, I don't know if that's why I have that or it just might be alcoholism. I don't question it. But anyway, so, you know, I saw a lot of drinking and the destruction, and, you know, I had good reasons to really not drink, and I didn't, you know. What I did with that, rather than start drinking right away, because, I mean, I sponsor people that hit their first bottom at 16. I mean, I've got a girl now. I mean, I see a lot of people that are full-blown alcoholics. I feel so bad for them. I got to drink till I was 36, you know. I feel so sorry for them. But, what I did with trying to comfort myself in what I know now, feel that God-shaped hole, is I decided I'm not going to be like them, and I proceeded to be very driven to fill that with things. And what I did is I became very involved in school. I was a champion swimmer, And I had a lot of people that kind of knew my family life, and so they kind of took me in and did a lot of things for me that were very kind. And I remember that I felt so weird and different and ugly and less than, you know, that was the thing. I just never felt right. I don't fit in. So I would identify groups of people that looked happy and like they had it together. Well, cheerleaders. I'm from Kentucky, and basketball rules, go UK, you know. And cheerleading is a big deal. You know, that's like the upper echelon, and people look up to them. I'm like, that's what I need. So I proceeded. Well, I'm 5'10", and I'm about this big round, and, you know, like really ugly duckling type stuff going on. And, you know, cheerleaders are like little short, cute, little curvaceous, bubbly, and I look like this walking Frank Bride of Frankenstein or something. I mean, you know, I was a late bloomer. I know I look good now, but back then, you know, long nose, and just, you know, puberty and all that. And so I couldn't make the cheerleading squad, but what I did is I was so driven that I would watch every move they made and studied it, and then I would practice every day. And in Kentucky, cheerleading is a real art. I mean, it's a sport, and you would have to do back handsprings. I turned myself into a gymnast in my backyard. And it reminds me of Bill's story, how Bill Wilson talks about how, you know, this boomerang that he made, you know, people told his grandfather, said, well, only the Aborigines make the boomerang. He's like, I'll prove to them. You know, Bill had, I really relate to him. He's like, well, I'll prove to the world. And he was, I think in the records books, the first person that was an American that made a boomerang. And that's how I am. You tell me I can't do it, or I got my mind on it, I am so driven, I will get it done. And so I lived that way, and it all looks good, you know, on the surface when you're, oh, gosh, she's an overachiever. So I became finally made the cheerleading squad, but that wasn't good enough. I had to become the captain of the cheerleaders, and then I had to be all-district cheerleader. And then I was the president of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes and did all this stuff. And then I've got my dad, you know, like all my little nice little preppy friends are coming over, and he comes to the door to greet them in cut-off shorts with his junk hanging out, a white beater smoking a joint, you know. So I was already like this. I mean, he was a character. I mean, he would drink and smoke pot and just a hot mess. And I'm like little Miss President of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, because I was trying so hard to be not like them. So anyway, so, you know, in high school I didn't really drink, because that the president of the Fellowship of the Christian Athlete, because it's all about what I look like and what you think about me. Look at Debbie. I mean, it was Debbie Rice. In Kentucky, it's Debbie Rice in Kentucky. Look at her. Isn't she great? Yeah, I am. But just like the book says, we present to the world what we want you to see, but inside. So I'm going along, and I start having, so I'm an athlete, I'm a champion swimmer, I'm a cheerleader, and I start showing up in emergency rooms because I can't breathe, because I'm having these panic attacks. And I go, and I mean, I am like, I don't smoke, don't drink, and I'm an athlete. And I remember going because I could breathe, and the doctor said, oh, my God, you are like the healthiest person I've ever seen. There's nothing wrong with you. So I proceed to do that all the way up until 2005, going like, we don't know what's wrong with you, until they start giving me pills for that. But anyway, so I do know that my first drink was when I was 13. I did drink then, because I have two older sisters. I was 13, so they were like 15 and 16. Started liking boys, and again, I'm like the carpenter's dream, up and down, skinny, ugly, and my sisters are going to like a teen party, and I want to go. And for some reason, I'm like, I need alcohol. I don't know where that thought came from, but anyway, I go to my dad. I mean, this is the stuff when you start telling your story, it's sober, and you're like, oh my God, that's crazy. My dad bought me the alcohol. I'm like, I need some booze, Dad. He's like, okay. So he gets me like a pint of some rot gut bourbon, and I pour it in a Tutti Frutti cherry Coke or something, and I drink the whole thing. I get to the party, the room starts spinning, and I black out and throw up for days after that. So my very first time I drank alcoholically, and I blacked out. So so that I proceed to go on through life, and, you know, the rest is, I was telling James, my story's so boring. But anyway, I really didn't start drinking on a regular basis, I guess, till, you know, I got out of high school, and then I was going to marry some little boy. It didn't work out, and I started working right away. And because I'm tall and I started filling out, I was 18, but I looked like I was, you know, like 25 or so. And so I started going to happy hours and all that, and I really had a great time. I did. I started, you know, going to happy hour and hanging out with the girls and, you know, whatever, and did that for years. And, you know, many, many times I should have gotten DUIs. I did. I mean, I look back on it now. I mean, we would go, you know, I lived in a small town. We'd go to the next big town that was like an hour away, Evansville, Indiana, and just drink and drink and drink. And I would drive back like with one eye and then go to, you know, get home at 5 in the morning. And when you're 18, you can do that. I'd go to work the next day with the same makeup, still look good, and then go do it over, you know, again. And so finally, you know, my parents, I was just independent, doing my own thing, drinking. And, you know, the worst consequences, I would get in trouble for being late for work and stuff like that. Then I moved away to Lexington, Kentucky. That's where a lot of my friends that were going to University of Kentucky. And so I moved in there and just, you know, partied and did what 18, 19, 20-year-olds did. I was there until I was like 20 or 21. And I met a boy there, and he had gotten a job over in Richmond, Virginia. So we were all disbanding from the apartment, and so, you know, I came over to Richmond to be with him, and ended up marrying him. He was my first husband. And the first consequence I had with my drinking was leaving a party that was with him. He played tennis, and he was in a tennis tournament. We'd been at some little fancy country club, blah 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 thing, and you know, drinking, and I left and got pulled over, and they took me in and got DUI, and I was highly offended, you know. And I thought I could talk my way out of it, and I realized I had a bracelet on, I remember, and I thought I was gonna be able to sweet talk my way out of it, and you know, and he's like, then I'll see, he's like, let me see your arm, and then he's like starting to handcuff me, and I'm like fighting a little bit, and I take my bracelet and throw it, and then they're like, oh my god. And you know, and so anyway, I got taken in, and he came and bailed me out. But I remember, you know, at the time, you didn't have to go to AA. I had to do the ASAP thing and all that. And that was the first time I really even had to consider. I'd never really even thought anything about drinking because it was fun and it worked, and that's what everybody I hung around with did, you know. But they sent me this ASAP, and I'm like, my God almighty, these people are trying to convince me and I'm an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic. I mean, what is the deal? But I had to comply with the conditions to get through the class and all that. So I do. It was just kind of a blip. But I remember thinking, you know, they said I couldn't drink during this time frame, and I didn't think that rule quite applied to me. I remember thinking I shouldn't be drinking, but, you know, and I drank anyway. So that was the only thought that went through my mind, you know. I was like, well, I just won't drink on the night of the classes. So anyway, you know, I proceed on through life and get married and, you know, still have panic attacks and end up at the hospital and, you know, different stuff. And I remember finally one of my drinking buddies, she was telling me I need to go see her doctor. He gave her these little white pills that helped her with her panic attacks as we were sitting drinking our wine and everything. By then I'm probably drinking alcoholically, but if you're like me, you find people that drink like you do, and then you don't realize how bad you are. So I started, I went to this doctor in my late 20s, and you know, I told him about these, you know, episodes and where I, you know, feel like I can't breathe and I feel like I have a brain tumor and dying and a stroke and a heart attack all at the same time. And he says, you've got panic disorder here, take these. So I started taking those and took them for years, just never thought anything about it, you know. So I don't consider myself a drug addict at all. I'm a pure alcoholic, but there are certain things you have to do if you like to drink like I do and crazy like me to keep you going. And certainly the psychotropics helped me keep going so I could keep drinking. And so anyway, proceed on with life. The first marriage doesn't work out. I left him. And then, you know, I continued during all of this to succeed in business. I'm a very driven person. You know, I need certain things, and so I began my career, and I've worked in telecom data type business and did real well. I'm in sales and did real well. And so got self-supporting, and this is how self, you know, I stayed with him until I could make enough money to not have to rely on him. When I started making my own money, I'm like, I'll see you later, and left, you know. And so that's when I met my current husband, who is an awesome, awesome man. We worked together, and we were friends, and I think he's been here to speak. He's Bob S., and he is a fine member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I always say he's the better half of the Sangster family for sure. So we met at work, and then you know, we had been friends, and I was going through a divorce, and he started going through a divorce. We thank God for amends. Anyway, I was the other woman. Anyway, I'm really good friends with his wife. She got a much better deal. She's a really nice husband and a nice wife. So we're this program really works because she's like a girlfriend. Her and Bob have a great relationship, but that's the case when I came in the picture, and he had a 6-month-old child, and he left her for me. And we clearly weren't in a program of recovery or leading a spiritual life, but it was a match made in heaven because we were drinkers. We like our drink. He liked drinking on a daily basis. He likes drinking Big O. Like, he had me fooled. He calls them stadium cups. I'm like, honey, nobody knows what a freaking stadium cup is. It's a big, you know, plastic cup about that big and that big round. He would put ice in it, fill it with vodka, and put an olive, and that's a martini. And I thought that was a martini. I thought that was one drink. That's like about 5 drinks. So he would have his martini, and then I would drink bottles of wine. In the beginning I drank fancy ones, but at the end I would drink a big bottle of Marcus James, the big ones. What is that? I mean, you know, the big, big, not the regular size, but the big, yeah, Magnum. And then I would drink a big bottle of red wine, then I would drink apricot brandy and beer and everything. But anyway, so we drank on a daily basis, and we had a good time, and, you know, everything goes along. And, you know, I am still doing well in my sales and all that, and he works for the same company. But then something starts happening. You know, I have all this underlying fear, you know, that the white little pill is kind of taken care of, but then I'm having to drink more and more. And so, you know, with me, there's always, like, I always have to pin how I'm feeling on something and analyze the situation, come up with a fix, and get into the solution and get what I want to make me okay. So husband number one was clearly the problem, so get him out of the way and get a much better looking version, a much sexier man, which was Bob, so I got him. Well, now I know what's wrong, because this guy, she told me, like, that, you know, the sex was great and everything, but now, like, something's missing. Oh, I need to have a baby. We need to get married and have a baby. So I convince him of that, and so then we have our child, who's wonderful. He's born in May of 1994, and so that did it for a while, and also, in the middle of all that, you need your dream home, too. So we built the dream home. So finally, I have everything that I thought I needed to make me okay. Because, you know, I don't know if you're like me, like you get everything you think you need, and then you kind of think, well, the reason I'm drinking like a pig is because of the finances or the way I was raised, or I don't have the right man or the right woman or the right whatever. Once I get that, then I'll be okay and I won't need to drink that way. Well, you get all that, you're still not okay, and then you're drinking even more, and then you're like, And then you're waking up in the morning with this terror in your head. Like, oh my God, what's wrong with me? Like, who can you talk to about that, you know? Who understands, like, I feel like I want to die and drink myself to death, but I can't, you know, like trying to put into words like why I'm feeling such despair and such remorse and such pain and such confusion. So all I can do with that is drink a little more. So that's why I like to start drinking in the morning, because I don't like dealing with those things in the morning. It makes it difficult to get through the day. So vodka in the morning helps to soothe all this stuff, so I can think and figure out what my next move is so I can get in the solution, get what I need, and get my life in this little box of space and time that I have in Debbie's world. So anyway, this, you know, I'm getting all this stuff, and so my son was born in 94, so somewhere between May of 94 and August of 96 is when the bottom fell out. That's when I hit my first bottom in August of 96. That's when I end up in my first psych ward. So what starts happening is I have the baby, I'm happy for a while, and, you know, all the Band-Aids that we put on the boo-boos, then it's still not enough. And I remember, you know, look at this beautiful home I had that I built from scratch, everything exactly like I wanted, had the right car, the right job, and I would go look at that beautiful child laying in the crib and just hurt. I couldn't be happy about this. So what is wrong with me? What is wrong? I've got a beautiful husband, this baby, and I feel like I want to kill myself, you know? Well, let me go drink, and I'll think about it. So anyway, I continue on with that, and that's when, you know, the drinking got, you know, like my drinking, what happened is when I got pregnant, I got deathly ill and couldn't stand the smell of alcohol, so I didn't drink alcoholically. I couldn't, and I think that was God's protection plan. But I remember the minute I had the baby, you know, how they have this little, like, romantic dinner for you and your husband, and they have apple cider and steak, I don't know, whatever, and I insisted he bring a bottle of wine. He didn't. I was so pissed I couldn't even enjoy the dinner. I was like, you didn't bring wine? I mean, the minute I had that baby, the minute we got home with the baby, I couldn't wait for his mother to leave. I couldn't wait for Bay to leave, and man, I got it on. I was like, you know, because I think the hormones of having, you know, God just protected that baby. But man, here's me, and this is why I drink. And the book says it so well in the doctor's opinion. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Yes, because I can't stand the way I feel. Can't stand being sober. Though they admit it's interest, they cannot, after a while, differentiate the truth from the false. Their drinking life's the only normal one. It's the only place I feel safe. They are restless, irritable, discontent, depressed, psychotic, bitchy, moody, whatever, until they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort. It comes by taking a drink. And that's me. Man, I can't stand the way I feel, and then I roll through life, get everything in hand, nothing's enough. And then, boy, yes, I put steroids on the restless, irritable, discontent. Now I'm bored and like, oh, what's next? What's next? I'm running out of ideas, you know. So so I can start getting all psychotic. So I go see my doctor, you know, because I have to do follow-ups after having the baby. He says, oh, I think you've got some delayed postpartum depression. Here, take these. And so I go back and see him another month or two later. He's like, well, that's clearly not working. I'm going to send you to a specialist in anger, a panic anxiety disorder clinic that specializes in that, and depression. So I start going there, and they just load me up. Listen, here is what I'm saying. If you have a medical condition that requires medication from a medical professional, absolutely, that is the course of treatment. What I was doing, I had a bad case of alcoholism, didn't know it, and was presenting symptoms that I know today are my alcoholism, that the doctor was trying to fix. They were doing their job. Do you think I ever told them once that I was drinking vodka in the morning and all day long? No. You know, so they're like, God, we're really puzzled. How much you drink? No, I'm just social drinker. No, well, you probably need a couple of drinks, and we encourage that, you know. So what they decided was that, you know, all this stuff going on with me, all this depression and anxiety and psychotic behavior, that you know, it probably had something to do with this horrible childhood I had, and, you know, that they were sending me to the specialist psychiatrist to get the meds right, and they wanted me to talk to this woman that specialized in trauma and deal with those issues. So I'm doing all that, and that's all good and fine, but if you're not telling them you're drinking around the clock and like a pig, then it doesn't work. So I'm getting worse, not better. So anyway, so I'm doing all that and you know, trying to manage my life and pull it together, and just, I mean, it's all kind of a blur. But what ended up happening is, I finally conceded to myself that probably, and so here's how my drinking at the end. You know, I've always been a daily drinker ever since I started. And being in sales and marketing, it's very acceptable and encouraged to drink at lunch. And I would drink about 5 or 6 drinks at lunch. And then, you know, go at happy hour and drink. You know, that changed when I had the baby, you know, so I think by then the baby, I guess he's a couple years old, he's at daycare. So I have to start drinking in the morning. That, you know, I just remember just like, can I wait till 5 o'clock, you know, but I couldn't. I mean, the horror was on me, like my mind racing, my insides trembling and just, you know, and then you start kind of not being able to keep commitments and having to lie and, you know, I'm balancing everything and trying, and all I really want to do is just, I want oblivion because it's warm and fuzzy and I can sit and get in my head and get that warm glow that alcohol brings, that smoke cigarettes and look off into space and like, you know, it's really not that bad and dream of all these ideas of how I'm going to get it together. And you know, I guess it's a delusion and sanity that I was very comfortable in. So I remember thinking that maybe drinking did have something to do with all these problems and that at the time I was working from home and my sales and marketing job, oh my God, is it on the phone? And I'm still not sober, not even the first time. So I remember thinking that I need to get dressed and go on over to the office where we have secretarial support, and because I'm staying at home drinking all day and all night, and so I'll go over there and be around people for them doing my sales calls from home and stuff, and that will make me stop drinking. So I get myself together and put on my, and I'm like, God, this dress is kind of tight, and then I look in the mirror and I see this bloated wreck. I mean, I look like some old hag, my face, I'm like, oh my God. So I'm like, you know, I'm going to go to work tomorrow. I'm going to go to the ABC store and get my own bottle of vodka so my husband won't know how much I'm drinking. And so I went over to get my own bottle of vodka, and the shakes are on me. And my shakes were, you know, externally, but also internally. I shook inside my soul, my head, like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And then the drinking would quiet that down so I could think and do something. So I went to go get the bottle and to make me a spicy Bloody Mary, because that always kickstarts me and makes me feel good and kind of lets me catch my breath. And I couldn't get a buzz, and I couldn't get there. I couldn't get relief, and I went insane. I just went insane. And somehow I made some calls, and I ended up in the psych ward. And that was in August of 96. That's where I learned, that's where I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where I take meetings up there now today. I love it. That's where people brought the message to me up there. And I remember thinking, you know, I got there. I'm like, what's wrong with me? I'm just like a wreck and falling apart, thrashing about. And they're like, you're an alcoholic. And it struck me sober. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm an account executive at AT&T. I mean, you know, like, I just was ignorant. I had no, like alcoholism cares what job I have, you know. So anyway, they're like, there. And so I was there for about 10 days, and they told me, they had a family little class thing, and Bob, you know, my husband came, and we learned about, you know, from the medical professionals, alcoholism, and then you know, was introduced to AA, and they told me, you're lucky to be alive. You've been taking heavy doses of Klonopin, which is a benzo, with drinking, and those are the only two things that can kill you when you're detoxing off them. So yes, you will stay for 10 days. You have to be medically detoxed. I didn't know that mixing those two things also could be very dangerous. So anyway, I still didn't believe I was an alcoholic, but I was scared enough about my drinking because I really, you know, started looking at, like, I really shouldn't be drinking. And I did try to stop, and I couldn't. But it's because my dad's dying of cancer, probably. I always would put why I drank on something, and my dad was dying of cancer at the time. And it's because Bob's probably cheating on me, and, you know, and he wasn't. I mean, I was just thinking, you know, all these different things, and I had to pin it on something. So I went to AA, and I might have to fast forward here. I went in. I was in for about a year and a half. I waited 3 months to get a sponsor because I needed to find someone perfect that I could relate to. poor thing. And I got this one. So I've had four sponsors, and they're all 20 to 25 years. They've all have remained sober and are great members of AA. I got this woman, and, you know, what I did and what a lot of people do is the very gifts that I get from AA, I come and, you know, show up here, my knuckles are dragging the ground, I get a sponsor to tell me what to do, and then I start feeling better, I start working better, start getting my life back, and I'm too busy to come to these meetings, and I'm too busy to listen to you. And plus, I'm smarter and richer than you anyway. Why are you telling me what to do? And my hair certainly looks better than yours. And, you know, just very superficial stuff. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, you know, she was speaking to me early. So this is a true story. This shows you how arrogant and. So I had this home group because they told me I had to get one. And so I decided they read that same thing, How It Works, Traditions, and the Promises every single time. And being the smart person I am, I don't need to hear that. And I'm so busy right now. I'm going to get there about 15 minutes late because I don't have time. I barely have time to come to these meetings. And then, you know, so I would come to the meeting late. And, then of course, I'm the first one to share and throw my stuff out there because my sponsor was just a really nice lady. So I remember one night after the meeting, she said, Debbie, I think it would be a good idea for you to get here 15 minutes early, and you could need to start connecting in with people and explain to me why I need to do that. I looked at her and I said, you know what, you're lucky I'm even here, I'm busy. And she's like, oh. Well, anyway, then she put, a lot of y'all know, probably knew Sammy. Sammy was her sponsor, so Sammy starts, it was taking a village, you know, and they were all trying to help me, and then I ended up drinking. I was like, screw them, you know, like, and my thinking was, man, knowing what I know now, just like Bill, the self-knowledge of alcoholism, man, I'm never going to let it get that bad again. And Bob was very happy. He was happy to have his drinking partner back. So he's like, okay, well, we're going to get one bottle of wine. We're going to share it, and that's it. I'm like, I think that's a good idea. So I start drinking again. That first night, we share the little wine. I get real nervous. I'm like, oh, my God, that's only like two drinks to me, and we both got to share that. And I'm like, God, how much does he have? Well, he went to bed. I drank the rest of the bottle and anything else. I think I was drinking like gross stuff, like triple sec, anything that had alcohol in it, and I got blackout drunk and got on the phone and called people and was a wreck for 11 months. And then I drank again from the first I get up after I throw up. I will drink, what I did was get juice drinks and drink in a coffee cup and drink first like some rum and juice, vodka and orange juice. I will have about six of those because it's orange juice. And then that gets me calmed down enough. Then I'll have a spicy Bloody Mary. Then I would drink anywhere from a 6-pack to a 12-pack of beer. Bob's at work. And then I would wait till he gets, then I would zone out, pass out. And then he would come from work. I would have his martini ready. And then I would start on the wine. And I would drink a big bottle of Marcus James, the Chardonnay. Then I would start on the red wine. Then I would drink about a pint of apricot brandy. And that's how I like to drink, with a little clunk. So anyway, you do that long enough, and if you're a real alcoholic, your body doesn't like it too well. And so I started having some severe physical things. And I remember on November the 12th of 1998, I'm in, you know, another one of these binges. I'm drinking. What time am I supposed to stop? Okay. So anyway, I, you know, he's a big drinker. I mean, he's a drinker. He can drink. And I remember one of my girlfriends called, and he didn't realize I was down in the basement. I picked the phone. I heard him talking to her saying, I don't know what to do with her. She's drinking herself to death. And I said, hang up the phone and go up there and smack him and say, you drunk, you. But all of a sudden I stopped him like, oh, my God, he's right. I am. It was like this moment of clarity. And I dropped to my knees. And I was like, God, please help me. Please help me. Please help me. And so the next day, I called a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew they went to the Jaywalkers. Like, oh, my God, they're going to, you know, because I had to drink in the morning. I mean, I had to drink in the morning. That was not even up for discussion because I had no other skill. I mean, I knew I'd end up at the psych ward again. And so I called this lady and I said, I need help. And she said, I'll be right there. And in my mind, I was like, she's going to tell me to come to that stupid meeting. I can't hang on till 7. And I knew if I picked up a drink, I would be off. And, you know, and so anyway, she came and she 12-stepped me. And so I proceeded. November the 13th of 1998 was, you know, the sobriety day. It was a Friday the 13th. And darn it, I'm so mad I relapsed because I was born on a Friday the 13th, and I got sober on a Friday the 13th. But anyway, it was awesome. I was fully surrendered at the time. My husband was not sober. I found out that it doesn't matter what is going on around you, whether somebody's drinking or not. If you really want to stay sober, you can. You know, my husband got sober in February 2000, and I was able to get sober, be a mother to that child, and, you know, allow him to have his own experience without me drinking. And so it really went well. And for the first 3.5 years, it was magical. And then something happened, and this is the thing that happens, I think I've seen it happen to a lot of people. There's these forks in the road. You know, again, I think I'm supposed to come here, work a few steps, help a few people, and be magically healed. There is a long process. You know, our book talks about there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. You know, this is just the tip of the iceberg. The alcohol is just the tip. There's something else going on with Debbie. And it's this emotional sobriety, and it's learning how to walk through things sober. It's learning how to be uncomfortable. It's, you know, I love, you know, in the book it talks about, this is simple but not easy. It means a price has to be paid. It means the destruction of self-centeredness. I got to continue to die to self. I'm a big old crybaby. I want what I want when I want it, you know. And so at 3.5 years, I remember I just started having a lot of the fear was coming back up, a lot of anxiety, a lot of, like, panic attacks and different things. And, you know, I was at another level, I think, of my spiritual growth and just, you know, just getting sober. You know, I've been on pills for years to handle my emotions. And so, you know, my sponsor was trying to encourage me to walk through it. And I was like, I don't like her anymore. I think I'm going to fire her. And I went and got somebody else. And then I started getting very fractured. I started doing a lot of self-help. I started doing A Course in Miracles. I started getting real religious. I just started doing a lot of things other than AA. I'm like, you know, AA is great for not drinking, but I clearly am a very unique, damaged person, so I need something else. And they told me to go find God, and they told me to get spiritual. So, you know, I went off to church and got, you know, as a Bible leader, I was, you know, running everything at the church. I think I've got codependency issues, so I've started doing some codependency work and some adult children alcoholics and, you know, started trying to fix my husband. And I lost sight of my alcoholism. So I ended up getting just crazy, and the panic came back so bad. I always joke with Al Jay, because every time I've been to one of his conferences back then, I went to the Pockets of Enthusiasm at the beach. I left there and had a horrible, full-blown panic attack and had to go to the hospital. Then when he had his Living Sober conference in Richmond, I left from that in 2005 and went, or when was it, 2004, and went to the psych ward 5 years sober, so I'm like, every time he asks me to speak, I'm like, no, but anyway, so I just end up, you know, losing, not doing what we do here. On the surface, it looked like it, because I've always gone to meetings. I enjoy the fellowship. But bit by bit, I was sponsoring a lot of people, and they start finding somebody else to sponsor them. And, you know, and I just got, so it would end up happening. It's 3 days after I remember picking up my 6-year chip. And by then, I'd already started back on the psychotropic path again to fix, because I thought, you know, I do have severe post-traumatic stress disorder. I do have a lot of this stuff, and I really do need something for this. And, you know, it's just not about not drinking. And I'm so glad it all happened. And I'm so glad I picked up a drink again, because I was on about 12 psychotropics. I've got my little discharge sheet from the hospital. I show it to my sponsors. They're like, oh, my God. I can't even tell you. I mean, I can't even believe that a doctor is allowed to prescribe that much medicine, but I walked around in a psychotropic haze. I call it my psychotropic purple haze phase from 5 to 6 years not drinking. And the best, awesome thing I did was pick up a drink 3 days after that. And I went into a blackout within about 15 minutes, and I called my current sponsor and cussed her out. And she's one of my dearest friends today. I was insane. And the rest is a blur. My husband will have to tell you. I was on, you know, they talk about this being progressive and fatal and chronic and progressive. I promise you, they're not lying. I had not drank alcohol for 6 years. My alcoholism didn't know that. It's like, yippee. I was off. I went to another level of insanity and powerlessness over alcohol that I can't even put into words, and I wish I could, so nobody ever has to do that. A lot of people don't survive. I have a lot of friends that are dads and women like me that didn't make it. And why I'm here, I don't even know. I don't question I'm here, and I'm grateful. But I was, you know, drinking around, like I told y'all how I like to drink, and that's how I drink. Now, before I started drinking, though, I did, you know, after, like, I relapsed 3 days after my six-year anniversary, I did try to come back, and I was around for 6 months, but I started drinking bottles of NyQuil and taking Klonopin and coming to AA. I'm not drinking alcohol. And then, you know, it's like, once you unleash that beast and you don't surrender and you don't go to any lengths, you're screwed if you're an alcoholic of the hopeless variety like me. I am powerless 1,000% over alcohol. It owns me. That's why today, everything I do, and I'm very sponsored, every move I make, every decision I make, is that going to get Debbie closer to a drink, further away from a drink? That's how I do my life. I will leave anything. If my job starts standing in the way of what I need to do to stay sober, I'll go get unemployment. I'll go do whatever. There is nothing that I'm willing to put my life on the line for today. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. And anybody knows me, you didn't tell you. It's true. People. I like people. But if you want to stay sick, you can go on over there. I can be civil and considerate, but as my sponsor says, you keep on getting it. If I want to be well, I need to know what that looks like. And I'll help anybody. But if you want to stay sick, I'm not your girl, because I like to get well. But anyway, so I am all over the place. But so I went to a hell of, I can't even tell you, and I wanted to come back, and I kept trying to come back. My husband was out of the country at the time. My son had never really seen me drunk. He was horrified. The damage I did to him, you know, I'm continuing to repay. He was between his fifth and sixth grade year of elementary school and middle school. Bob was out of the country trying to start a new career, and I'm, like, laid up in a blackout the entire summer. I wouldn't speak to anyone in AA. I hated AA, and I actually tried to go to a couple of meetings, but I had to pull over at the Wawa and get a six-pack. I could not. I got to a point in my alcoholism where I could not drink. I fell apart. I had to keep alcohol in me at all times to function. And so I couldn't make it to the meeting to pick up the white chip. And I remember I'd wake up in the morning like, I'm not going to drink. I'm going to call somebody. I'm going to get some help. And the best I could do, I couldn't even make a drink anymore. I would chug the vodka down as fast as I could to get some relief as tears were pouring out my eyes because I couldn't stand it. And I was hopeless. And then at the end, I was drinking as the sun would be coming up. I would be drinking red wine. I couldn't even go to sleep. I couldn't stay. I could not have a moment where I was in reality because it's just the stuff that we do is too hard to look at when the morning sun comes up and there's no alcohol. So I fix that and you just keep drinking till the sun comes up, you know. And I started losing some bodily functions. Some things started coming out that I didn't intend to. And fortunately, what happened is there had been a church I'd been involved in. It was kind of a recovery-based church. And one of the women in the church that was my age at the time, 46, had died. She had been like me, tried to quit drinking. She had blown her brains out. And they kind of like, where's Debbie? And so I'm drinking again. I can't stop. And they came and took my child and put it in a safe place and got me and put me in the hospital. And I just ran into the lady last night, the pastor of the church, and thanked her again. And I was too, you know, that's what happens to some people, like, oh, they're drunk, whatever. We can get, when they talk about delusion, they're not kidding you. I believed my own stuff. I couldn't make decisions for me. Thank God people made it for me. We get too sick to know what's best for us. You know, that's why I'll make people mad. I don't know, but I can lay my head on the pillow at night because I know I'm going to put you in the hospital or I'm going to make sure you get some help. We've had that recently with my sister-in-law, who James is good friends with. 4-6, I mean, we finally, like, we don't care what you think, you big Tom Lawyer. You're going in the hospital. She was drinking herself to death. She had lost touch with reality. And that's what happened to me. So I got another chance. And now let me tell you, I went to Father Martin's. That's a nice, expensive place. That bought me 8.5 months. You know, the great thing about me going away to rehab was it protected me from me. I cannot not drink. And I drank one more time, and then that was, you know, my sobriety is May 30, 2006. And what happened? The net of it, here's the most spiritual thing I've done. I ran out of ideas. I, of course, you know, I got a great sponsor. She's wonderful. She's just celebrated 24 years. Her sponsors, 34 years, are lovely women. It works better if you're honest with them and you keep in touch with them and take their suggestions. My dog could have sponsored me. I would stay sober better than me. But I always get, and then here's the other thing. This is why I've been able to walk through it. I don't have panic attacks. I feel anxious. And I had grave depression, too. I'm one of those people that talks about in the book, there are those two who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. That's me. But they can recover. And it's true. Here I am. What happened is I called her and said, and of course I hadn't called her for 2 or 3 weeks because I got depressed. And I went to go, man, because God knows y'all can't see me depressed because I got to show you something else. It doesn't matter. People take me as I am here. People love me. Billy's known me for a long time. You know me just as I am, and he loves me anyway. The people that get this deal love you just as you are. They don't care. You know, I don't care. I care about your life. So anyway, I was worried about what everybody would think as I'm laying home depressed and had to drink again. Left on my own, I will drink again. So I called her. I said, drink again. She said, okay. She went all dramatic. She said, well, what are you going to do? I don't know. She said, are you drinking now? I said, no, I'm not. And someone had come and taken my son. She said, go get your son. Do what you need to do. Come and meet me at the meeting and pick up a white chip. And I said, okay. And then she said, but the most spiritual thing was, what are you going to do? What do you want to do? I said, I don't know. Please tell me. I always tell you what I'm going to do. Well, I'm going to get back to the steps. I'm going to go to the meetings. I'm going to do 90-90. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. Well, the shine wears off. I love that. I took that from Bob Darrell. That's boring. I mean, my God. You know, I come here and I want to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm supposed to be healed and feel better and be the president of AA. You know, I'm just a member among members. I just get to show up here. And I keep putting one foot in front of the other. That is the best deal going. I wish I could have time to be bored. My life is so full today. I wish I wouldn't. People didn't like me. My phone rings all the time. It is awesome. It's awesome. I have a life that makes sense to me. I have a life that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and a great sponsor and all people like Billy and all the other members. It doesn't matter what I'm thinking, feeling, believing. I still have been given the power to help save a life by my mess of a life that I took and have a message through the 12 steps. Like, yeah, I understand if you feel psychotic. I understand if you feel like you can't do it. But you know what? We've got some power here. Come on anyway. So the only thing I've done right this time is I work the steps. I do everything that said. I show up despite what I think, feel, or believe. There is no reason that I ever miss a meeting. Now, I have a sponsor that's good sense. If I have a family function I need to attend to, of course I do that. You know, I do the things I need to do in my life, but AA is the center of my life. And as a result of suiting up and showing up here and keeping my commitments, I've developed this spiritual discipline where I can show up in every area of my life. Because I just got a promotion at work. I wasn't even looking for it. I've got hired at this job in March of 2011. I'm in sales and marketing. I work, work, work. Then they come to me and say, hey, we're starting this new strategic group. We've been watching. We like, you're very consistent. And we see you have a background in this thing. We would like for you to come. I'm like, really? I talked to my sponsor because usually I'm manipulating and trying to get and figure out. I've never had an interview that I haven't tried to get. And then I got the job, and it's an incredible opportunity, and I'm enjoying myself. But I know it's a result of the discipline and the willingness and what I've learned in AA of how to suit up and show up and be responsible and, you know, have a sponsor and all that. But I haven't come close to having taken a drink. I've walked through some horrible, tremendous things in sobriety. But life is life, you know? I mean, I have every tool I need. There's always a solution to every problem. And I have so many people to draw on their experience that have already been down the road that maybe I'm getting ready to go down, that I can use their experience, you know, to be able to not have to go off the deep end and drink again. But anyway, I'm just so grateful. And Alcoholics Anonymous is awesome. And I know just some days it just doesn't feel like it. But, you know, I just can't base anything on what I'm feeling and thinking sometimes. It's what I'm doing. And then I get to look at the evidence in my life, of the people that are in my life. And that this hot shot group would ask me to come and speak and record me. I mean, you know, hey. But, you know, it's a real honor. And if anyone is, you know, feeling doubtful or hurting, just, you know, really just give it a chance to be honest with yourself. And really, I always tell my sponsor, like, well, what, you can go drink. Let's do this for a year. Just get through the steps and, you know, quit doing all that. But let's just give it a try, then you can go do whatever. You know, you'll be better for it. But it does work, because I was about as hopeless and as destructive alcoholic as there can be. And crave emotional and mental. And I have a life that makes sense. And I've been given the power to live life successfully and to carry a solid message to help others. And that's a pretty good deal. Thank you.